Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everyone, welcome back to the show. Huge thanks to everyone who supported us on Supercast. We are nearing the 1 month anniversary of the launch. It's been incredibly huge. So A, it's made it so that we can increase the amount of shows we're putting out. So on Friday, we had our discussion episode where Sagar and I debated Twitter, Elon Musk, and most importantly, the student loan issue. Lots and lots and lots of audience response from folks. Secondly, it's meant that we're going to increase the number of interviews we do a week. So to everyone who wrote in for the topic of student loans, thank you so much. It helped me get the proper prep to book a guest on the topic. We're recording tomorrow. So we're going to release that interview as well too and help drive that show. So we're going to have three interviews this week. And then next week, we're going to also have those interviews and another discussion episode. So once again, if you haven't supported the Supercast already, if you could go into the description section in your podcast app or check out our Substack, which is also linked too. You can find a link there. You could give us $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. It's helping us expand and build a bigger show without just having to arbitrarily throw out paywalls there. But don't worry, we're going to be launching our community subscriber only features this month too. So be sure to check that out. On a deeper note, this episode today is also very important. It's with Matthew Continetti. He's a return guest to the show. He is the author of The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. Long, long, long time listeners of the show will know that we actually started with the topic of conservatism and how it's changing in response to a realignment of American politics and frankly, just the world, not just the U.S. domestic scene, but everything that's happening at home and abroad. So we brought him on to discuss his new book, The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. This episode is coming out today because this is also the day of the 2022 Ohio GOP primary, where our first ever guest, J.D. Vance, is going to maybe win a Senate seat. He received Trump's endorsement, which is a very important thing in a Republican primary, obviously. So if you're going to think about how you should think about this episode, think about how today's election results are playing out and how this relates to this bigger, longer debate that we've had. With all that said, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Huge thank you to our Supercast subscribers who support us as well. Hope you enjoy this episode and all of our increased content that we're putting out there. Thanks to everyone. Let's get into it. Matt Continetti, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. We didn't post this on YouTube, but we did an episode with you during the early part of COVID, and it was a terrible, all of our cameras are angled up at our chins. So it's good to actually look at you in a not terrible format. But we're here to discuss your new book. It's on the future and past of the conservative movement. But I just want to start by reading an excerpt from a piece you wrote at the start slash end of last year that honestly, if I could just steal it and have this be the sum up for what The Realignment's trying to cover, I'd really do it because this conversation on conservatism is operating within the environment that you describe as follows. So you write, "I cannot escape the sense that America has reached an impasse, that it has arrived at a moment of transition, not just on the matter of abortion. Whether one looks at politics, economics, or the world, one sees a realignment of forces, a shuffling of players, often on the stage, to prepare for the next act in the drama." What do you mean when you're describing this amorphous, but something is coming next moment?
Well, I mean that I have a sense that we're at an inflection point, that the politics, culture, diplomacy, all are changing. Whether it's the upcoming decision of the Supreme Court on the Dobbs case in Mississippi, which might result in the reversal of Roe v. Wade, whether it's the new forms of finance, crypto, DeFi, that I have trouble even comprehending, but I know that are increasingly important, meme stocks, whether it's in the landscape of foreign policy with Vladimir Putin's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine and all of the changes that are taking place in Europe. And then, of course, we look to Asia and the potential for a Chinese invasion of Taiwan one day. And then when we look also kind of about what are we fighting about? And you mentioned my book. For much of that story I tell on the right, left and right is fighting over the size and scope of government. When I look at politics today, it's not really what they're fighting about. They're fighting more about who's an American. What does it mean to be an American? What view should we take of American history? Whose values ought to be supreme in our society? And that's also kind of culture wars are not new, but the fact their preeminence and the way in which actually now the right has turned to using political power to combat the cultural institutions dominated by the progressive left. That I think is something new.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting you put it that way. When we think about it in the context of like the debates around government, it truly was, you know, sparked by the New Deal. And then we have the Eisenhower era, we have the Goldwater era, and it continues all the way up until maybe the election of Donald Trump. Maybe you can dispute that and give us some of that history. What historical period for the American right rhymes most with where we are right now in 2022?
Well, I've written a lot recently in the book and in an essay for the Wall Street Journal that when I look at the Republican Party today, I see a lot of political similarities with the Republican Party of the 1920s, of the pre-Cold War right. And even though Donald Trump and Calvin Coolidge are two very different people, their parties and their movements are somewhat similar in a few respects. The first is in their attitudes toward immigration, restrictionist, in their attitudes toward global economic competition and foreign trade, protectionist, and in their attitudes toward foreign intervention, very reluctant. A wariness of foreign intervention, a skepticism that America should be tied too closely to the fate of countries overseas. So in those three primary regards, I think there's a lot of similarities. And also, of course, both parties were for the entrepreneur, in the sense that, you know, within America's borders, within that protected economy, you would be anti-socialist, mm-hmm. right? You would want to have a competitive and dynamic economy, and make the claim that your party represented economic prosperity, which is what Coolidge did and which is what Trump did. But that in the end was not enough to save Trump in 2020.
And the question that I'd have here, I want to go back to what you said earlier, which is the fight between the right and the left for much of the 20th century was about the size and scope of government. I'll have a follow-up to this question, but the question is as follows: who won that fight?
Well, it depends on your standard of success. The foundational New Deal institutions, which the American right began to define itself against in the 1930s, still remain, right? Social Security is not going anywhere. The SEC is not going anywhere. All the agencies that FDR set up, the fact that Washington maintains a central role in the political life, in the social life, in the economic life of every American, that's something that FDR instituted. It's not going away. Many of the Great Society programs instituted by Lyndon Johnson in 1965 through 1968 still remain. Not all of them, but I'm thinking here Medicare, Medicaid. So on those questions, I think the progressive left won about the nature of the federal government, how large it should be, how involved it should be in people's lives. But on other questions, the right did win. on the question of taxation. The Trump tax reform, I think, demonstrated that there's a certain tax rate at which Americans are not willing to go beyond. And the Trump tax reform looks pretty safe, at least for now, in today's Washington. On welfare, and perhaps I think the greatest conservative achievement of the 20th century, the 1996 welfare reform abolished aid to families with dependent children, sent the program back to the states, but also instituted work requirements and time limits for welfare aid. That's a huge victory. It's often underappreciated. Unionism.
Can I pause you there?
Because
there's this trick in DC of titling things in ways that make them seem very reasonable. And you just came off as, let's just say, a little monstrous if you don't know the policy. You're saying the great conservative victory was ending aid to families of dependent children. What actually was the policy and what actually changed for younger viewers who don't, frankly, know anything about those welfare reforms?
Well, the welfare program was need-based. And there was no work requirement and there was no time limit. And it was called AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children. In 1996, as a result of decades of work intellectually, politically, the GOP Congress eventually got Clinton to sign a bill that ended that program and instead sent monies to the states to create welfare programs for their own, which included a work requirement for people receiving the grant and aid, as well as the time limits for the assistance. And at the time, people thought that this would only increase poverty and dependence, and it would be ruinous. And I think empirically, those claims have proven to be false. So just moving on to unionism very quickly, a huge part of the New Deal. But actually, beginning in the 1940s with the Taft-Hartley legislation, the right instituted right to work. And we looked at today, we see, of course, the Janus decision in the Supreme Court, basically saying that you don't have to contribute to a union if you don't want to. And you see declines in private sector unionization, as well as I just saw the other day a beginning of a decline in public sector unionization. Now, whether you agree with that, this is a good thing or not, it was definitely a goal of the American right for much of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a goal they've achieved. So I guess I would say on the big question about how big and how involved the government should be, the left won. But there are a variety of other questions about government, about how much it should tax, about how you should work the labor markets, and also about the conditions on which aid is provided to people in need, the right one.
And just a quick follow-up I wanted to hit there then. As you said, the transition is towards a much more identity, these broader questions. That seems to be the fight today. Do you think that transition is fueled partly by the fact that it feels that on the big picture questions, the right lost the debate? So if you're not fighting over values and identity, what would there be left for the right to do except just basically do that whole, we're Democrats, but slightly more responsible if your finances bit? I'm just curious. That's my reaction to what you're saying.
I guess I look at it a little bit differently. You have to distinguish between the intellectual and the political. Intellectually, there are many arguments that can continue to be made against big government. And there are plenty of places where I think there's work to be done to argue against the overreach of government. And in fact, in many ways, we do continue to argue over what is now called the administrative state, right? And basically, unaccountable bureaucracies or judges. Politically, the small government arguments are not saleable, it seems to me, at least over the last 20 or so years. When voters were suffering from stagflation, when they were suffering from a sense that the government was run amok in terms of the welfare caseload, in terms of the state's inability to control violent criminals. The types of arguments that Ronald Reagan made in 1980 were very saleable, very palpable. Bracket creep pushing you up to higher tax brackets. The idea that a tax cut would help you was real and true. In a non-inflationary environment, in an environment where violent crime was reduced to decades lows, in an environment where welfare reform had been a success, the small government argument didn't take. And so there are other arguments to be had. And it's including the cultural ones, right? Those came to the fore. Now, I do think it's interesting, actually, as we enter this new period, maybe not everything about it is new, because some of the issues we're facing are exactly those I mentioned at the beginning of the Reagan era. Stagflation, violent crime, out of control judges, right? I mean, so there might be a return of limited government conservatism, but not in the near term.
Yeah, it's interesting putting it that way, Matt. I think you already probably know this line of critique, but I feel obligated to bring it up anyway, which is when you talk about the conservative victories, you're not talking about some of the cultural animating issues that many people see as failures culturally, as America has drifted far more towards the left. How do you assess the cultural power of the American right in the year 2022?
I often get into trouble with my friends on the right, or not all of them are my friends anymore.
You're in good company. Don't worry. Everyone here is in trouble.
When I say that, I actually think the cultural power of the American right is stronger today than it was for much of my history. I think if you were to go back into the 19... now, you have to distinguish between the American culture and then the culture of the right. So take the 1950s, right, which we hold up to be a very conservative era. High levels of religiosity, the baby boom, high levels of church attendance. At the time, the American conservative movement was considered fringe. William F. Buckley Jr. defining himself against Eisenhower. Okay, so now we fast forward to 2022. Look at American society. Collapse of religious affiliation and attendance. Decomposition of the family. The sense, many social indicators, crime, deaths of despair, all very dispiriting. And yet the right is at the center of things, which is, it's vibrant in the debate. The Republican Party, much more conservative, capital C, than it was in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Podcasts like this, Fox News, the most popular and dynamic posts on Facebook are conservatives or from right of center personalities, talk radio. So, I think that the American right is much more involved in the conversation, even as the social and cultural conditions continue to deteriorate. And I think actually it's this dichotomy that frustrates so many on the right, that they can't they don't understand. We're here, we're fighting. We're able to win elections, and yet American culture and American society has not healed, has not experienced a conservative small C revival. And that leads to pessimism. And I think it leads to a disillusionment on the right.
So here's the part of the episode where we have to do the whole, what even is conservatism? Obviously, the answer is not one that's easy to answer, but I'll ask the question in a slightly more useful way. Is conservatism a set of policy and philosophical beliefs, or is it an identity? Because I think that that dichotomy is very important here, because you see, for example, and Sagar, you're subject to this given YouTube, where you'll see some YouTuber who is described as like center right or conservative, and people will freak out. They'll say, wait a second, why is the MSM saying Joe Rogan's a conservative?
Right. Well, Bill Maher is a good example. Bill Maher.
Yeah, well, right? Yeah, but I want to start with, he was always a libertarian, so he's actually not a useful, he's actually not like a useful one on that spectrum. Joe is more useful because Joe Rogan had Bernie Sanders on and he talked about Medicare for All. How can you say he's a conservative? Well, if you look at the issues that Joe Rogan talks about today, crime, how much California sucks, how much he loves Texas, how much he loves guns, Navy SEALs, MMA, all these things that he's interested in today are identity objects for people who are conservative. So I guess what I'm kind of trying to get at here is
that spells trouble for me if MMA is now a litmus test for conservatism.
MMA is very right.
Side of the times, I guess. Yeah, no,
UFC,
I know.
UFC is conservative.
Well, I know that John Milius designed the octagon, and of course he's in my right wing pantheon, so that makes sense. But I confess, I'm not a follower of MMA.
Well, one quick thing then, Sagar, you then said he's right wing, which is useful. Which is right wing different than conservative? Because what I would say is Joe Rogan is right wing, but he's not conservative. Matt, yeah. Like, how do you think about all these terms, how this plays out?
Well, this is why I call my book The Right and not The Conservatives, because I think you have to distinguish between a right, which opposes the left, but which is a broad spectrum of ideas and of figures from, you know, Chateaubriand, Catholic reactionaries, to Irving Kristol and the neoconservatives championing classical liberal values, right? Against a progressive left. So there's the right, and all of the names that you fit into, that you mentioned, fit into that right today because of the various issues that we're debating in America at the given moment. Then there's the American conservative movement. And the American conservative movement is a very distinct political formation. It comes out of the Second World War, comes out of the beginnings of the Cold War. It defines itself, as I just said, against a popular Republican, small c, conservative president, Dwight Eisenhower. Why? Well, because Eisenhower wouldn't abolish the New Deal, and Eisenhower wouldn't roll back the Soviet Union. Basically, he kind of ended up in continuation of Truman's containment policy. This conservative movement, it captures the Republican Party in 1964, nominates Barry Goldwater, goes down to the feet, but it still remains a huge presence in American life and is vindicated or reaches a culmination point with the election of Ronald Reagan. And so when I structure my history as a 100-year story, beginning in 1921, ending in 2021, that conservative movement is actually kind of an aberration when set against the broader right, right? And this is when I say that the right today looks a lot like the right 100 years ago. It could fit in different figures, and it can include people who would not have fit in with William F. Buckley Jr. and the National Review crowd. I don't think Joe Rogan would really hang, you know, I'm sure maybe he would have visited Buckley in the Masonette on Park Avenue, but it's not, they're not really the same type of person, right? But now he is situated on the right because of the realities of American politics and society today.
Yeah, I mean, see, this is the interesting part too around the definitions and when you say the right. So when we talk about the political project also then of the Republican Party, how does this shake out, right? Because Goldwater, and this is a famous story that everybody knows who's come up on the right, you know, he seizes the Republican Party, but leads it to electoral disaster. And it takes 16 years for the Goldwater Revolution to actually culminate in the election of Ronald Reagan. So what sorting are we in right now, Matt, in the context of the book? Like, what needs to be sorted within the GOP? Because I see Trump, and you described the Trump, for example, as protectionist, as skeptical of foreign intervention, and critical of mass immigration. All of those three things are true in rhetoric, and yet completely well, debatable in terms of policy that was enacted. So how, and does that even matter in the shakeout period of trying to figure out the actual aims of this eventual political movement, which is downstream from this broader political phenomena that we have right now?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a it's a complex one. I was struck, as you were saying, that Trump in rhetoric was different from Trump in reality. Of course, many American conservatives said the same thing of Ronald Reagan.
True. Yeah.
Throughout his 8 years. And we're often telling Reagan that you were not living up to what you said you would do, right? Government did not shrink. Taxes did. Non-defense spending did. But as a whole, it did not. Traditional social mores were not restored over the course of the 8 years. So oftentimes in Reagan's policies toward the Soviet Union, especially in his second term after he begins negotiating with Mikhail Gorbachev, the American conservatives were highly critical of Reagan's embrace of arms control in the final years of his presidency. So it's very similar, right? And in fact, there were often during the 4 years of Trump, people would say, Trump needs to be more Trump, right? Just as people used to say, let Reagan be Reagan, right? So no one will ever be satisfied. That is, I think, a conservative insight. But it does mean that these are still significant figures, right? And that what they say is directional and intentional and does move these political formations in a certain manner. So Trump, I think, represents the growing force of populism on the American right, which has always been there and is a theme in my book. But I believe that beginning in George W. Bush's second term, Bush policies on immigration and the war began creating a fissure between the Republicans and the conservatives in Washington, D.C., and grassroots voters, Republicans across the country. And so the populism that we could have seen in, say, Pat Buchanan's 1992 presidential race and Buchanan again in 1996 really takes hold, begins to take hold on the GOP, partly as a consequence of the in-migration of whites without college degrees into the Republican Party, which has been going on for some time, but really picks up over the last 20 years. And this populist wave that begins around 2006 has only gathered strength since. And so Sarah Palin was another indicator of where the party was headed, the Tea Party. Then you get Trump. And now you see a place where the people who really composed the conservative governing class of the Reagan and Bush years have either made their peace with the new shape of the American right, or have been disestablished, and in some cases left the Republican Party and conservatism entirely.
I want to build on, I think we're just going to spend the rest of the episode throwing different phenomenon at you that we've just picked up in these conversations. My takeaway from doing this show for almost 3 years now has just been that in this context, the education gap between the two parties and the fact that, once again, if you're more likely to get a graduate degree, if you're more likely to be even attending a four-year university, you are going to be a Democrat, is probably one of the most defining issues of this sorting. Because what that means is that institutionally, we talked about this on our most recent episode, if you are in a position of institutional control, you are going to be a Democrat. What that then means, though, is that folks who find themselves disagreeing with those institutional positions find themselves pushed towards the right, whether they want to be on the right or not. So I think this explains a lot of the intellectual dark web crowd. Once again, most of them, the Weinstein brothers, Barry Weiss, et cetera, et cetera, to certain degrees, will hold positions which are not conservative. They're not right wing. If you place them in the year 2005, they'd appear very different. but they are just pushed to the right because so much of what seems to catalog all these various groups on the right is just opposition to the status quo, the establishment, pick your pejorative, pick your description. What do you just think about this dynamic? Because I am just like increasingly, I don't stop ranting, but this is just what I keep thinking about. I'm increasingly frustrated by people who are now on the right, but yet refuse to pretend that they are on the right right now. So if you are a person who wakes up and thinks that free speech is the defining issue of this moment, and by the way, I mean free speech in the sense of like content moderation, YouTube discussions, but et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that means you're not a member of the left right now. And there's a lot of very harsh disagreement about that fact. So like, what do you think about this dynamic?
Well, in a moment of flux, like we're in, you can find yourself not a part of the left, but still unsure about where you belong on the right, if you do at all. And it just makes me think, Marshall, of the first wave neoconservatives who spent an agonizing number of years in the 1970s, actually in some cases going into the 1980s, deciding whether they were Republicans or not. And people who were part of some of the same institutions you mentioned, obviously tech did not exist in the 70s, but communications, academia, right? It's the same thing. People who disagreed with the reigning views often faced cancellation 1970s style. I talk at some length about Professor.
What was 70s cancellation?
Well, it was ostracization. It was being heckled. It was a little bit more violent, actually, than in today. I mean, Cornell in 1969, anti-war activists and Black Panther activists take over the university with guns, right?
Ben Shapiro's routine does not work as effectively back then.
Not the same thing.
Trigglypuff fights people aren't, back in the
70s. I mean, thank God people aren't bringing guns to Ben Shapiro when they, you know. Yale campus in the same year, firebombs going off in the town commons there in New Haven. So that's what cancellation looked like. In the case of Professor Banfield, the Harvard professor, he writes The Unheavenly City, really goes against all of the political correctness of the day. He finds it almost impossible to work at Harvard. So he actually, I mean, this is for an Ivy League academic. This was, you know, this was perdition. He had to go to Penn for a year, right? But eventually Heavens. He got back. Oh. Yeah, I know. It's awful. But that was Banfield's cancellation. And of course, cancellation in a larger sense, which I think is incredible contribution to political science, is not recognized today. So they're in these communications, intellectual media, high, you know, kind of the professional classes. They dissent from what's happening at the time, the rise of the counterculture, the rise of the anti-war movement, permissiveness in society, affirmative action. And yet they can't bring themselves to say that they're conservatives. It takes a long time. It's this process of integration and assimilation. I actually believe that something similar may be happening now with some of the figures that you mentioned, we might not, you know, Joe Rogan might not call himself a conservative today, but let's check back in 10 years.
And quick fun fact, correct me if this is incorrect, but even the term neocon was a pejorative that people put on them.
That's right.
So yes. Even that term, and actually, could you, sorry, what you go, but we need to correct this. Can you explain the difference between the first wave neocons and the neocons that I'm sure most listeners are thinking of, which sure. is 2000s era foreign policy, and it's now a pejorative. Who are we actually talking about in the 70s?
Well, it was always a pejorative, right? but I guess even more so now. The first wave of neoconservatives were ex-radicals. They had been radicals in the 1930s and 40s, but basically de-radicalized in the 50s, became anti-communist liberals. But by the late 60s and early 70s, they were looking at liberalism and finding it very weak, especially in its embrace of big government programs that did not achieve the desired result. And so that's Irving Kristol, the so-called godfather of neoconservatism. That's how he ends up on the right. He's actually the most conservative of that wave of neocons. He's also the only one to become a Republican. But other figures around him, Nathan Glaser, Daniel Bell, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who goes on to become the senator from New York. Just incredible intellects. There's a second wave of neoconservatives that comes about in the mid-70s and early 80s. And they are Democrats who, because of the Democratic Party's turn toward a policy of neo-isolationism after Vietnam, embrace of the nuclear freeze movement in the early 80s, opposition to the Reagan doctrine of support for anti-communist guerrillas in the global South, they become Republicans. But that takes time too. So these are figures like Gene Kirkpatrick, Elliot Abrams, William J. Bennett. And then the third wave, the wave that people think of today when they hear the word neocon, they weren't ex anything for much of their lives. Many of them were the children of the first two waves of neoconservatives. And they were associated with a foreign policy of, they called it neo-Reaganite, but it was a policy basically of American hegemony. So America's a global power. We're the sole superpower coming out of the Cold War. We need to be involved all over the world. And we need to press the case for democracy and human rights in every theater. And we need to embrace tactics such as preventive war and regime change in order to guarantee the survival of democracy in the 21st century. And that's figures like Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan, Max Boot, many of whom were associated with the magazine where I worked for many years, the Weekly Standard. And ironically, they are now ex as well. They're ex-Republicans. So you go from first wave ex-radical, second wave ex-Democrat, third wave ex-Republican.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I want you to weigh in on a really interesting debate that has kind of taken the American political scene in the last couple of days. Maybe our editor can put this up there on the screen, but I'm sure you've seen it, Matt. It is the meme that Elon Musk tweeted out about left, center, and right. And for those who are just listening, I'll do my best to describe it. It says that in 2008, there was left, there was center, and there was right. And the person who appears in the center is on the left of center. In 2012, that person looks as if they're slightly more towards the center, as the quote-unquote my fellow liberal is much more to the left. Then it shows another person in 2021 with a conservative standing the exact same place that they have been since 2008, a person who is now center towards the center right, and then somebody all the way to the left who says woke progressive and that they're a bigot. So I think this describes a couple of things to me. Number one is the phenomena of asymmetric polarization, as in people who are left-leaning have become much more dogmatically left. However, at the same time, people who are on the right, I don't think it's entirely fair to say, while yes, maybe holding some of the same policy decisions, clearly there is a phenomena of paranoid, of populism, which doesn't necessarily have a policy platform, but is manifesting itself. But we do find exactly what you're talking about here, this new center. I've kind of taken Matthew Walther's moniker and really run with it, the idea of the barstool conservative, somebody who is animated by fights about political correctness, critical race theory, trans ideology in school, but does not necessarily care about abortion or gay marriage, and in fact may even be nominally pro-choice and pro-gay marriage, and yet culturally center-right in the context of the 2022 debates. How do you think that that new coalition is going to affect the policy direction of the right going forward, given the fact that something that you have written about, and I actually completely agree with you, is that a real coming to heads for the GOP is the upcoming Dobbs decision, where it's extraordinarily likely that Roe versus Wade is overturned by the Supreme Court, which could really put at odds new voters who are right wing with the traditional conservative movement. So I know I just threw a lot at you. Take of that whatever you want.
Oh, thank you. There's so much there. Maybe I'll attack it in reverse order. I would say that with Dobbs and Roe v. Wade, there were many writers, including me, who, when Texas passed their fetal heartbeat bill in September, basically outlawing abortion in Texas, mm-hmm. I said at the time, I said, hold it. Did the Texas Republicans just hand Biden and Obama an issue in the off-year elections? And I was closely following the election in Virginia, where I live. And I had thought for a while at that point that Glenn Youngkin could win. And so I was wondering whether this might affect it. There was no blowback.
Yeah, there wasn't.
Abortion has basically been illegal in Texas since last September, almost for a year. There's no blowback. Mm-hmm. Greg Abbott is sailing to reelection. So that's
and if this, Matthew McConaughey had run and beat him, it would not have been because of abortion.
And of course McConaughey won't run because he wants to remain a popular figure, as a unifying figure in American culture. So I'd say right now, and of course I was wrong in September, I could be wrong now, but I am actually undervaluing the chances of an electoral blowback because of a reversal of Roe, if it happens. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the Democrats and the media won't try to make the election about abortion. And this is where I think abortion politics cuts against the GOP often. It's one thing to say you're against Roe v. Wade, and there are many reasons to be against Roe v. Wade. It's one thing to say you're pro-life. There are many reasons to be pro-life. It's when you get down to the details, right? And even these heartbeat bills, which I support, that the opinion can be polarized on or can be contested. But then when you look at, say, candidates in 2012 in the Senate, for example, people like Todd Akin making these comments about legitimate rape, things like that, in reference to abortion, that can definitely hurt a candidate. So that could happen. But overall, I don't think the blowback from a Roe reversal will be that big. Second thing would be the Barstool conservatives, mm-hmm. and its relation to that meme that Elon posted. And I just like how Elon now, all he has to do is post a meme and all of America starts talking about it. I mean, that is Trumpian. I have to just say, why are we not talking about Elon potentially running for president 2024?
Because he's born in South Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
If he was American, he would run and he would win.
He would not have bought Twitter.
He would have run in 2024.
He would have done both. But yes, thank you for that reminder. In fact, I was just taping an interview and someone played me the clip that from MSNBC recently that said that he wants to go back to apartheid. I mean, oh my God. Anyway, so that's just on his cultural power, which is astonishing. I think there's something to that graph. Look, everyone recognizes this phenomenon called the Great Awakening. I pin it to Ta-Nehisi Coates' case for reparations in 2014.
100% agree. Yep.
This is the power of ideas. Something happened. Now that essay, of course, and ideas have to kind of hang on events, right? So it's Trayvon Martin, it's Ferguson, it's a case for reparations, it's 12 years a slave, right? It's all coming out at the time. Something on the left changes, and suddenly white progressives become more radical on race issues than most Black Americans. And that's present in the public opinion data. And that's propelling these woke liberals, most of whom are white, to the left, right? And that continues to shape our politics. I mean, it's partly why Trump won. People hate to be called racist, and if the message from all of our major cultural institutions, 24/7. Is that a majority of this country is racist, or this is a racist society, you are handing the Republicans the keys to Congress and the White House. That's just the case. I would say, though, on the you're right, Sagar, to point out that for the conservative outline or figure in that meme, if you asked the issue positions, I don't think they've gone to the right that much.
Right.
Attitudinally, however, mm-hmm. they've become more extreme. So the sense that we have to fight, or the idea that America is on the verge of collapse or civil war, the openness to conspiracy theories, the openness to strongmen, that all I think has changed since 2012. But as even though the substance, it hasn't, and it's kind of, it's something that we saw in Trump as early as 2015, especially before he became president, when he was very heterodox on some questions, like single payer healthcare, for example, right? If you just looked at his policies, he was actually kind of a moderate business Republican. But then, of course, you listen to Trump, and he's not that at all. He's mm-hmm. he's outlandish. He's boisterous, braggadocious, all of these things. And that, I think, speaks for a lot of people on the right today.
Two things. One, that speaks to, I think, the useful way you broke down Elon's meme, because what the meme misses is it's just focused on, once again, center-right, left identity, not institutional parties and membership in the parties. So I think people who identify as Republicans, quote-unquote, which doesn't fit the Barstool person that Sagar's talking about, doesn't fit Elon, I think they have clearly gotten more extreme in those functions. But that's a different question than the pure, let's put American every single policy outcome on possible. That has shifted. The right has not shifted to the right, and it has shifted left, so I agree with that. So here's my question then, and this gets to the question of whether or not recent Republican victories in the social sphere are going to be impacted by Roe v. Wade being overturned or not, which is Republican success dependent on Democrats or just progressives, liberals, leftists, whatever, overreaching beyond the cultural sediment we could describe in 2015? AKA gay marriage is legal. Abortion is legal in blue states. It's going to be severely impacted in red states, but still Roe v. Wade isn't overturned. Trans bathroom bills are aligned too far for corporations. They say no to that. And there's very little like big backlash. It actually, you know, before the vice presidential thing, it actually severely, that his attempt to pass it, like severely damages Mike Pence's presidential campaign in 2015. So is there a world where if Republicans start moving beyond that 2015 settlement, they then get in trouble? Is basically the way I'd ask the question. Because that's what you could say the Democrats are doing. Like the things that we're talking about, Glenn Youngkin, it's okay, we're moving a step beyond what we saw as consensus in 2015. Could that happen to the right?
You know, it's a great way to frame the question. I think I view it a little bit differently. I agree that Republicans' biggest victories in the post-World War II era have been the result of progressive overreach. It's been the result of the faults of the left, not the merits of the right. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes the question of, does the right have an agenda that will be able to prove to voters that voters made the right choice, or will they overreach? So if I look at the rise of Richard Nixon, that's the result of, as I get into in the book, the decomposition of the Democratic Party over Vietnam, over the rights revolutions, over the counterculture. If we look at Ronald Reagan's, it's because the world basically falls apart in 1979 with stagflation, with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, with the Iranian hostage crisis, Jimmy Carter's perceived incompetence, all these things. If you look at the Republican Revolution in Congress in 1994, same thing. Clinton runs as a new Democrat in 1992. And then begins governing from the left, and the public repudiates him in 1994. And it's the same, I think, with the Tea Party Congresses in 2010. Obama runs as this unifying representative of a rising generation of Americans, a 21st century cosmopolitan America that will move beyond the Bush legacy. And he comes to power, and it's revealed that he actually has a very ideological view of the world and an agenda he wants to pursue, whether the public agrees with it or not. And that gets us 2010 and 2014. So I think we're set up in 2022 for a major Republican year. Major. Because what did we see? We saw Biden win basically an anti-mandate in 2020. His anti-mandate is to not be Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all Biden had to do, was not be Trump. But instead, his grandchildren and John Meacham convinced him that he is FDR and LBJ combined. And so he decided that he was going to govern like Elizabeth Warren, even though he had run as not Trump. And the result is the inflation. The result is the border. The result is everything going wrong. the Afghanistan withdrawal debacle. And so once again, Republicans are in a position where they're going to make major gains because of Democratic and progressive overreach. And the question will remain, will the Republicans have an agenda? Will they be able to moderate expectations of their own voters of what is possible in divided government that will give them the opportunity to build on 2022 and 2024? I have to say, based on my study of history, I'm not very optimistic, but I do think the GOP is set up for a good year this year.
So I think two last questions from me on this. So first would be, there are a lot of debates that Trump, let's just say, won, right? When we're saying the right feels more Trumpy, that's immigration. That is a lot of things directionally with foreign policy, especially when it comes down to rhetoric and framing. But something I wonder what you think about is, how has the war in Ukraine shaped how a possible second Trump term, or even let's say a DeSantis term, once again, a politician who is in this weird, not weird, but pretty straightforward to understand, like in between space. So Trump wins the China debate. But as people like John Bolton have said, one of Trump's ambitions in a second term would have been pulling out of NATO. That position seems much more up for grabs in 2025. In terms of how the right thinks of these things than it did before, especially given the fact that the Europeans are now spending money, which technically pushes aside one of Trump's arguments. So how do you just think about how the war, that's my interpretation of how the Ukraine war is reshaping that foreign policy like space. How do you think about that issue?
Well, I think a few things. First, I think the fact of the invasion has quieted the forces on the right who were viewing Putin as a global defender of traditional values, as someone who was misunderstood and as someone who had legitimate grievances against NATO and the West. The simple reality that this was an unprovoked invasion that has now gone on for over a month and has involved many atrocities is hard to deny. And I think it's made all Americans, Republicans and Democrat, right and left, extremely sympathetic toward Ukraine and Ukraine's President Zelensky. And I think it remains to be the case that people support the United States supplying aid to Ukraine. And sometimes you'll hear Republicans say, well, we need to supply more aid or different kinds of aid. The MiGs, for example, or heavy weapons like tanks. However, Americans are still reluctant to become directly involved in this conflict. And that is especially true on the right and the left. And no-fly zone, that's not up for debate in today's Republican Party. Committing forces, like we would have done in the 1990s, if this was Serbia, for example. that's not up for debate either. So we just need to appreciate the nuances here. With 2025, Trump has a fixation on our European allies that I think goes back 30 years. So no matter what happens in Ukraine and the fact that the alliance has been strengthened as a result of the war, I would still imagine President Trump back in office antagonistic toward our European allies. He thinks we're being cheated by them. He's always thought that. That's why he levied tariffs on France, right? I mean, he got into more fights with our traditional allies, the Europeans, the Canadians, than he did with Kim Jong-un. I mean, let's just, he's buddies with Kim Jong-un, right? A DeSantis administration may be different. And I do think it's interesting that DeSantis, while staking out such wide ground on the cultural issues, turning Florida into basically MAGA land, and a place, by the way, that a lot of people want to live. They kind of like MAGAville, right? He doesn't talk about foreign policy all that much. We really don't know DeSantis' foreign policy. When he was in the House, his foreign policy was quite hawkish. Mm-hmm. You know, will be very interested to see where he comes out. I would expect President DeSantis to support NATO. He would talk about burden sharing, I'm sure, but he would not want to stress test the alliance like Trump did for various reasons. So we not only have to distinguish within the pro-Ukraine opinion, we also have to distinguish between Trump and DeSantis, which I think we'll be doing a lot of distinguishing between the two of them in the next 2 years.
That's a good point.
So for the last question, you know, you're teaching a class at American University. You teach a variety of courses for young people on the right. I'm just curious, like, talking to precocious 18 through 25 year olds, like, where are they? How are they seeing the world right now in 3 minutes or less?
Well, they're all over the place, and a lot depends on which students I'm talking to. American University students tend to be very involved in partisan politics. They're basically where the Republican Party is, which is a Reaganite party now with Trumpian overtones, right? Mm-hmm. So they're still, you know, they view Trump as necessary, but I don't think that they're sold on Trump's return to the White House. I think they'd be very open to a DeSantis or to someone else. When I speak to other groups, perhaps more self-selected groups who are, interested in this intersection of ideas and public policy, I mean, they're all very interested in the American New Right. That's just, it's a consequence of being young. Of when you're young, you're curious, and you're curious about the most exciting ideas. And these ideas are exciting, even if they're actually very old. It's a consequence of being online, because that's what we're talking about. But it's also, thirdly, a consequence of where we are as a country right now, where the fights really are over the cultural power of the left. And these institutions, like the university, like the media, like social media and the tech platforms, that have exercised tremendous power over what we discuss and how. That's really what's happening, is that discourse itself is now the issue. Mm-hmm. And I think turning down the volume on the left's megaphone, that's the new unifying principle of many on the right today.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. I think that's really well said. We're going to have a link down in the description to the book. I highly recommend people read it, just because I think you've given people a very good summation and some historical background through which they can view the future. So Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. And Matt, can you actually shout the, this always helps, just specific. What is, we keep saying the book because there's a subtitle, and I always forget the subtitle. What is the actual book?
Give us the title.
The book is called The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. And I urge everyone to buy at least one copy.
Don't worry.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Matt.
Thanks,
Matt. You have a good radio voice. Did you do the audiobook for it? I was thinking that you have a good voice.
The book is 450 pages long, so I would not put myself in that position.
That's a good 20 hours. That's pretty
exactly.
Long.
Yeah.
All right. Man. Well, sorry, people. Someone else will be reading the audiobook version, but I hope you all check it out either way. Reminder: Substack subscription, Bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.